I'm Dee Dee Madigan, and this is The Wrap-Up, the Daily's weekly podcast rounding up all of the news that you should know about. Election Day is now just days away. If you haven't voted, there's still time. Ballot boxes are located throughout Seattle, including one by Schmitz Hall. Today is Friday, November 2nd. Last week we discussed initiatives 1631 and 1639, and we had Dr. John D. Wilkerson give us an overview of the more competitive races in the state. This week we'll take a look at the other two initiatives on the ballot, 1634 and Initiative 940. Daily writer Max Wasserman reports on 1634.
I'm Justin Marlowe, professor in the Evans School of Public Policy and Governance here at the UW. It's an interesting initiative, and like a lot of initiatives, there's what the ballot measure says, and then there's what it's really about, which are maybe quite different things, depending on your perspective. So officially, what the measure would do is it would prohibit any local governments from any local government in Washington state from imposing a soda tax akin to what the city of Seattle recently put in place. And so it doesn't change Seattle's current tax. What it does is it would prohibit the ability for any other local government in the state to do that. Now, the on the one hand, some have argued that this is a way to keep groceries affordable, that it's good for the working poor. Anytime, basic taxes on, or sales taxes on basic items like groceries are regressive and they create problems for the poor. And the idea here is that on the one hand, prohibiting additional sales taxes on groceries is important because it will try to make an already regressive tax system maybe a little bit more fair for people. And I guess I should back up too. It's not explicitly a prohibition on taxes on soda. It's really a prohibition on other local taxes on groceries generally. However, groceries, for the most part, have already been excluded from large parts of our sales tax system. So at the state level, there's already a prohibition on sales taxes on groceries, or effectively a prohibition on sales taxes on groceries. And very few local governments have any kind of a sales tax on groceries. It's kind of part of the culture of Washington State's tax system is to try to avoid imposing those taxes. So the idea that there are, many local governments out there who are looking to impose a sales tax on groceries, like the one that Seattle has done, it depends on your perspective. Some say that that's just not going to happen because there's very few local governments who want to do that. And some say that a lot of cities might try to follow Seattle's lead and put in place a tax on groceries targeted primarily at the soda tax, the sweetened beverages tax that Seattle has right now. So the idea is that it will kind of prevent other local governments from doing what Seattle has done.
In that initiative, it seems that there's also the question of, would this ballot, if it passed, affect working class families who might be having to pay more? How much truth is there into that argument?
Yeah, well, it's hard to know, and it's not really something that you can study directly. Anytime, again, the fact that most places in Washington State don't have any kind of a tax on groceries means that it's just not something that has been studied. It's not something that has been looked at very carefully. And it's really hard to know what imposing a new tax would really do if it was done on any, if it was done widespread, if a lot of different cities would do it. In concept, at least, in as much as sugary beverages are consumed largely by, working class folks, you could make the argument that a tax on those kinds of beverages would disproportionately affect, the working poor, that they're going to pay a larger share of taxes. They're going to pay a larger share of their income in taxes because they're more likely to consume those products, and because a sales tax generally just takes a bigger bite out of their wallet. That's the nature of how the sales tax works. At the same time, if we define effect on families maybe a little bit broader, there's been lots of work that has shown that these taxes in places like Seattle, where they have been imposed, have actually improved health outcomes for the working poor. That when you put a tax on something like sugary beverages, it's designed to discourage people from drinking soda in this case. And when people drink less soda, their health outcomes improve. There's less concern about diabetes and all the other problems that come with it, which is exactly what the public health advocates of this tax were hoping to see. And so there's been some evidence that the effect on the working poor has actually been quite positive, whether or not those health benefits balance out the fact that the working poor having to pay more for the same stuff. You know, that's kind of a bigger picture question about the overall benefits and costs. So it could, yeah, it certainly affects working families, you know, in lots of different ways, some positive, some negative, depending on which side of the argument you're looking at. Very different ways of thinking about this philosophically around the state. And so for that reason, it'll be really interesting to see if it actually passes. It kind of gets in some ways at the heart of what you think about taxation, your philosophy about who should levy taxes, what is a fair tax, who should have the right to levy taxes, you know, those kinds of questions. So it's about lots of different things all at once. It's not really just a yes or no kind of a vote.
For those unfamiliar with Initiative 940, you'll need to know a few things. A state task force was charged with figuring out how to reduce law enforcement shootings. They narrowly voted by one vote to make the recommendation to remove the requirement of proving malice in order to prosecute a police officer who used deadly force. This refers to a 1986 Washington State Shield Law, which protects officers who use deadly force as long as they acted with good faith and without malice. However, the legislature did not act, prompting the citizen group De-Escalate Washington to get enough signatures to put the initiative on the ballot, which would put an end to malice. This is where Representative Goodman comes in. Representative Goodman worked with both law enforcement groups and De-Escalate Washington to try to come to a compromise.
So I'm Roger Goodman. I'm the representative from the district's in the suburbs of Seattle, including Kirkland and Redmond, the 45th district, and I'm a chair of the Public Safety Committee in the House. The key controversy has been the issue of what we call the malice requirement, that if there is a police use of deadly force and it's called into question as to whether force should have been used or not, the prosecutor in the case needs to consider whether the law enforcement officer had malice toward the person that he shot. And that is effectively a bar on any prosecution, because how can you prove that law enforcement has personal bias against that individual? It's almost as if you'd have to convict the charge and convict the law enforcement officer of first-degree premeditated murder, which is not what law enforcement officers do.
2005 and 2014 in Washington State. However, only one officer was charged. Officer Mike Solon, the campaign manager for the Coalition for a Safer Washington, and the president for Compass, the Council of Metropolitan Police.
And I said, aren't there elements of your initiative which could be improved? And they acknowledged that we could broaden and improve the language of the initiative. And they said yes, except we don't want, what happens is when you amend an initiative in the legislature, what goes on the ballot is the original initiative and the amended version sort of in competition to one another. So the voters have to choose sort of option A or option B. And the community members, the proponents of the initiative, did not want that. And so I suggested that we take the initiative as it is and pass it without any changes, but then also fashion a separate bill, which we did, and that took an intense effort, and yet that bill wouldn't become effective until the initiative became effective. So it was sort of amending it ahead of time, because what happens is the legislature passes an initiative, but it doesn't become effective law for 90 days. There's actually a referendum period when someone can challenge it. And so we wanted to keep that referendum period alive. But this process was challenged, and it went through the courts, and the state Supreme Court said, no, you can't pass an initiative to the legislature without any amendment, and then pass a separate bill that amends it ahead of time. the state Supreme Court said this is going on the ballot, and as was originally intended. And what we're hoping is that the initiative passes, and then when we come back in the next legislative session, which begins in January, we will then pass the same bill that we tried to pass before, but at that point it's perfectly constitutional. The initiative has been voted on by the people, and then the legislature can come back and amend it. The legislature can only amend an initiative that is voted on by the people by a two-thirds majority, so a supermajority of the legislature. And I think that we will be able to achieve that because there are many legislators who do not like the initiative. They think that it goes too far in removing not just malice, but also weakening what's called the good faith exception. And this is really the key to the entire agreement. We were focusing on this good faith test. The prosecutor, if deciding whether or not to bring charges, would no longer have to prove that the, or would consider that the law enforcement officer had malice against the person, but the prosecutor would consider whether the officer acted in good faith. And that was the language that we very carefully negotiated. But basically, a good faith test is, would a reasonable law enforcement officer have used force under those circumstances? So we have that language ready. We hope that if the initiative passes, that we'll come back in January and make that amendment.
Officer Mike Solon, the campaign manager for the Coalition for a Safer Washington, and the president of COMPASS, the Council of Metropolitan Police and Sheriffs, which represents King County Sheriffs, Puget Sound Police Managers Association, and the Seattle police officers at the state level, talks a little bit about why these law enforcement groups do not support the initiative.
Across the nation, let me break it down to you statistically from the FBI. So in 2015, there were 8,248,709 arrests made by law enforcement. Within those contacts, 991 of those were fatal shootings. So if you break those numbers down even further, the number of blacks killed by police was 258, the number of whites was 495. And to even further break those numbers down, that's a 0.01% of anybody having a deadly force confrontation with police across this nation. Think about those numbers. So when you compare them to 250,000 medical deaths, people on the operating table per year, think about that. 991 fatal shootings compared to 250,000 deaths on the operating table per year. Whereas police encounters of deadly force is 0.01%. You can't tell me that there's a national epidemic or there's local epidemics when it comes to police deadly force encounters.
The numbers that Officer Sloan cite from the FBI are accurate. However, it is important to note that the FBI has relatively limited data and are thought to undercount the number of deaths by police. Additionally, Officer Sloan notes that out of all of the arrests made that year, a very small percentage of these cases resulted in deadly force confrontations. Again, it is important to put this into perspective. In 2014, The Economist found that the number of deaths from police shootings in the U.S., according to the most recent data, totaled 458. This is in comparison to just 8 in Germany and 0 in Japan and Britain. It's true that these three countries are much, much smaller than the U.S. But here's another way to look at it that The Guardian put together. The average fatal police shootings a year in Canada are 25, and they have a population of about 35 million. California has a population of about 38.8 million. They had 72 police shootings in 2015. Australia has had 94 fatal police shootings between the years 1992 and 2011. The U.S. had 97 fatal police shootings in March 2015 alone.
The information in Washington is the fact that we all want safe communities. Absolutely 100%. I'm a human being. I took the oath of office to lay my life down in protection of others. So is any other police officer wearing the badge in this state. Now, I'm not saying we're above accountability. We all want to see ourselves be held accountable, but not under 940. This is horrific language that is detrimental to our communities, and that should have everybody concerned. And I can assure people that if community is calling for deadly force reform, then fine. We'll lead that charge. We'll take a seat at the table. We'll all agree to a reasonable definition of good faith. 940 doesn't get it done.
The law enforcement group Compass was one of the groups that did not support Representative Goodman's amendment to Initiative 940 when it went through the legislature as a separate bill. This was the amendment that more clearly defined good faith. Some of the endorsements from law enforcement include current King County Sheriff Mitzi Joannette, the Black Law Enforcement Association of Washington, the Law Enforcement Action Partnership, and the National Black Police Association. And lastly, the other news you should know about. The University of Washington continues to struggle with minimal state funding. Daily reporter Jake Goldstein Street reports that the university's budget will increase by nearly $600 million from last year. However, the university expects to see a 2.2% rise in in-state undergrad tuition, while out-of-state students can expect a 3% rise. The lack of funding from the state goes back to the recession when it lost about half of its funding between 2009 and 2012. The University of Washington ranks third to last among 22 similar institutions in terms of state funding per student. Mackenzie Murray reports that the Sexual Assault Prevention and Bystander Awareness Program, Green Dot, has been quietly phased out due to lack of funding and results. Green Dot served as a workshop which groups and communities on campus like fraternities and sororities could use to get training on preventing sexual assault. Although Green Dot no longer exists, aspects of the program will continue to live on through other workshops. This past Monday, the Daily published their endorsements. Here are some of the big ones. For U.S. Senate, Maria Cantwell. For the U.S. House of Representatives, Pramila Jayapal. For the 43rd Legislative District, which includes the University District, Nicole Macri for Position 1 and Frank Chopp for Position 2. For the Washington State Supreme Court, Position 8, Steve Gonzalez. Yes on Initiative 1631, a carbon fee. Yes on Initiative 1639, which covers gun reform. No on Initiative 1634, regarding future grocery taxes. And yes on Initiative 940, which deals with the end of malice. Visit the Daily's website for a complete list of endorsements. That wraps up this week's news. Don't forget to vote. I'm Dee Dee Madigan, and I'll see you next week.